This episode of the Cocktail Lovers podcast is sponsored by Passoa Passion Fruit Liqueur. Welcome to the Cocktail Lovers podcast. I'm Gary.
And I'm Sandra.
And together we are the Cocktail Lovers, a married couple sharing our passion for the artistry of drinks.
We've been writing about cocktails in our eponymous magazine and website, but this is where we talk about cocktails.
In each episode, we'll be sampling the best products from spirits and mixers to non-alcoholic tipples and pre-mixed drinks, highlighting our pick of the books to add to your cocktail library and shining a light on the bars to have on your radar.
We'll also be checking in with some of the biggest names in the industry to hear what's going on in their worlds, as well as asking them for their tips on making quality drinks at home.
We like to think of ourselves as your new best friends, cocktail wise. So let's hear what's on the show this week.
We're back with season 7, so naturally we wanted to hit you with the good stuff. We start with a very special gin, the delicious, just released The Abbaturret from the makers of the Glenturret whiskey from the oldest working distillery in Scotland. We stay in Scotland for our second product, the Bruladdy, a beautiful single malt created for modern palates. Our book choice is simply stunning. It shows off the artistry, elegance, and incredible drinks behind one of our favourite spots, the world-famous Connaught Bar in London, while Birmingham comes under the spotlight in our bar review of Passing Fancies. All of which sets us up nicely for our interview with film director turned gin maker, Paul Feig. First, he makes us a martini, then talks us through his incredible career. Listen in, and also, for the first time, you can see the chat. Check our website and let us know what you think. But first, we are the Cocktail Lovers, so let's make ourselves a cocktail.
First cocktail of your new season.
I know. How are you feeling? It's been quite a while, hasn't it?
Yeah. I hope my shaking skills...
A little bit rusty, are we over there?
Well, maybe. We're about to find out. Or you're about to
I'm
find out.
I'm about to find out. Okay. So what are you coming back with?
I am coming back with a gimlet. And I don't know if we've had a gimlet on this before.
I don't think so. But if we have, I'd think it's not too bad to do it again.
Same again, please.
Absolutely.
So gimlet. And I'm going to chat and mix at the same time, a chat and make at the same time. So a 19th century even cocktail, and like so many things born out of the old Navy, they used to light the lime to stop the scurvy, but they used to put the lime with some neutral alcohol, but then that got replaced by cordial, which is the sort of version we kind of
that's
came
what we
to
grew
know.
Up with, I guess.
Yeah, the Rose's Lime version.
Mm. I say grew up with, like we started having them when we were 8 years old.
No, we used to have Rose's Lime cordial and fizzy water if we were.
Yes,
lucky.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, I love Rose's Lime cordial when I was growing up. Nowadays, I do find it a little bit sweet.
I remember once, not that long ago, we fancied a gimlet. We had no cordial, because it's not sort of something you just keep on hand, is it? So I tried making this sort of version with fresh citrus and sugar syrup, and I thought, well, actually, that's really rather nice. So that's the version you're getting today. Mm.
And also, more and more in bars that we've been going to, they're not using the lime cordial.
No.
They're making their own, and they're doing them with different acids or, you know, all sorts of things. So I think it's really nice to... that you don't have to have the Rose's Lime cordial, but you can if you want to. And that's a good sort of gateway in, because it is sweeter, it is softer, and it is the way that they were traditionally made. Yeah. So, come on, let's get on with it.
So while we've been chatting, I've put into my shaker, I've put in 60 ml each of London Dry Gin, nice London Dry Gin. I'm now going in with my sugar syrup. I'm using 15 ml each, so 30 of that.
And what sort of ratio have you done the sugar syrup?
I have made this 1-to-1. So I made this about, you know, 10 minutes ago or something. So half sugar, half water, shook it up. Bish bosh. That is your sugar syrup.
Mm-hmm.
And then same amount of freshly squeezed lime juice. So again, 30 each, that's 60 in total. So yeah, 60 gin, 15 lime juice, 15 sugar syrup. Couldn't be easier. Now just get some ice into my shaker. Oh, I've missed this.
Stop pretending you haven't been making cocktails while we've been away. Not recording, that's what
not
you mean.
Not recording, right. That's all in. Got my glasses chilling away. Oops. And right, okay. Get on the shaker. Right, are you ready? Stand back. Right, here we go. Feels good. Right. Oh, blimey. That's cold on the hand.
Good, as it should be.
As it should be. Discard. I've been chilling our lovely Nick and Nora glasses. That goes, away goes the ice. In goes the lovely gimlet. Looks nice and frosted. Right. Perfect measures, I'm pleased to say. And finishing off with a little lime wheel on the side there because it looks nice and fancy. And let me pass it over to you. There you go.
Thank you so much.
Right. Do a little cheers to the first episode of the new season.
Yep.
Cheers. There's your gimlet.
Here we go. Fabulous.
Pessoa passion fruit liqueur at the heart of the original Porn Star Martini, and bring in a tropical passion fruit twist to all kinds of cocktails. See Pessoa.com for inspiration.
Something new, something exciting, something absolutely blooming delicious.
Right, blimey.
I know, exactly. So it's something from a recent trip that we did last week. We went along to the Glenturret Distillery up in Perthshire, to the Glenturret, which is the oldest working distillery in Scotland. And they're much more used to making whiskey. Everyone knows them for their fabulous whiskey. And also, more recently, for its amazing Michelin-starred restaurant. Not one Michelin star, but two, which is a fantastic. And I think it's the only distillery, actually, that has a Michelin-starred restaurant, and it's the only two Michelin-starred restaurant in Scotland. So that's aside.
That's a whole lot of facts and figures.
There's so much going on. There's a lot going on here. But this was particularly for the launch of the Abbaturret Gin by Joel Harrison, and we've got lovely Neil Ridley, and also Peter Jausch from Switzerland, who consulted on the gin. And it really is fantastic. Now, first of all, let's talk about this bottle.
Yeah.
Gary.
It's a beautiful. Oh, wow.
It's so heavy, isn't it?
It's
I mean, that tells you it's luxury straight away, doesn't it?
Yeah. It's got something of the sort of decanter about it a little bit. Not, you know, not in design, but that's that feel of like elegance and, as you say, luxury. But the actual shape, it's very minimalist. What? Yeah, it's
very deco style.
Deco,
isn't it?
Thank you. That's it. But it's, I don't know, what's that color? Is that green?
Yeah, it's a beautiful green. I must say that the Glenturret is owned by Lalique. So that's part of the reason why it's so gorgeous. And, and actually, those sort of Lalique signatures come through in the bottle. Yes. You've got these lovely angled, lovely ridges here, the three ridges at the bottom of the bottle. You've got these lovely angular shoulders at the top, and it just looks like, you know, I mean, come on, that's
it
sitting on
the shelf.
It feels
lovely when you hold it, doesn't
it? Yeah. Yes, yes. It's blooming heavy, though.
It is. It's when you handed it to me, and it's like, oi.
Yeah. Absolutely. So let me talk about the gin. So that's the bottle.
Yeah.
It's made with 14 botanicals. So there's the juniper, coriander, angelica, the usual kinds of things. But there's lots and lots of citrus in here. So there's lemon, lime, and grapefruit. There's licorice root, pink peppercorn, pine, chamomile, and sumac. And I didn't realize that sumac actually was something that they grow in Scotland. I always kind of think of it as Middle Eastern sort of spicy flavors. Okay. But one of the special things that they've done is they've used the new make spirit that you find in the Glenturret whiskey to actually use that in the mix as well. So you've got this lovely signature style of the Glen Turret whiskey, which they've cleverly brought into the gin.
That's a nice idea.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm sure you want to taste.
I do.
Oh, look at that bottle. It's so great. Also, while I've just uncorked it, you can smell. I don't know if you've got it over there, but the smell of that is coming through. I shouldn't say smell because that makes it sound like it's smelly. The aroma, beautiful, absolutely beautiful.
Well, on the nose, what's it's that? It's got a nice pininess.
Yeah, absolutely. The pine is there. And also that lovely citrus, because there is so much citrus in there, lemon, lime peel and grapefruit. So that's wonderful. I love that. Already you can tell it's beautiful in a martini, which we tasted quite a few of them with this. It's quite viscous, isn't it?
And it's got, I don't know if just a light, it's got almost like an orange golden glow to it.
Mm. It's lovely. Really, really good. It's very smooth, which I love, and quite creamy. You feel that?
Wow. Yeah. It's what ABV is this, please?
It is 45.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, it's funny thing with gin. We've said this a little bit over the last year or two, that you're starting to think of gins as things you could sip, you know, and this is very sippable, and you could just have this over ice, couldn't you?
Absolutely. Yeah. And one of the things I love about this, not just that lovely citrus and the pine that you're talking about. I love that little spicy hit that you get from the sumac, but also there's that maltiness that comes through from the new make spirit, which I think gives it's a really lovely character to this.
Yeah. And I like that very much.
It's really, really good. And the three guys that have brought it together, they were giving a talk about it and how it's taken them 2 years actually to get the recipe just right.
Yeah.
And I think it does show in this. And one of the things they were really, really careful about was that it had to work in a martini, had to work in a Negroni, and also a gin and tonic. And I think they've got that spot on. It's absolutely gorgeous. And I mean, the bottle, we've got some lovely gin bottles along with 71 and things like that. But this is another one that's really sort of for the cocktail cabinet, whether it's full or empty, it's taking pride of place. It's
beautiful. And the spirit lives up to
it's absolutely beautiful.
Yeah.
And talking about the Abbotarrant, they've just opened a beautiful guest house as well, but you can have it for private hire.
Oh, hello.
Six rooms, four of them are queen size or king size, two double, and it is amazing. You must go onto the website to see it. They've got so much going on there. So not just the gin, not just the house, not just the whiskey, but also the restaurants as well. So how much is it, do you think? What would you say?
I don't know. Just tell me.
£45, one for each ABV. So that is the Abbotarrant Gin, and you can find details of it on our website and also in the show notes.
So we're staying in Scotland.
We
are, So I am going with my first choice for the new season with Bruichladdy, which is a ILA single malt Scotch whiskey. And I think I'm going to jump straight in to hand you this bottle because I know we talk a lot about bottles and packaging, but it's so important. And look at that for a Scotch
whiskey.
Well,
you couldn't get more different from the bottle that we've just had. It's really great. They've both got very distinct characters. This one, as a whiskey, and especially an Islay whiskey, is so different. It's an aquamarine matte bottle with bold white type. So very, very distinctive.
It's super modern looking.
It's very modern. And even though it says the classic laddie, it doesn't look classic as a bottle.
No.
It's just very punchy. I think that it's definitely designed to stand out.
But for different
reasons from the Abbotarrant gin.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, what I like about this, you know, is once you get sort of past that look, there's a reason, I think, to it, because they talk about it's an old Victorian distillery that they reopened in 2001.
Mm-hmm.
And there's so much you could say about what they're doing, but they talk about reimagining what single malt can be And, you know, they talk a lot about, you know, the provenance of the barley they use. I mean, all of their barley is Scottish barley. They talk a lot about terroir because some of the people involved in it come from a wine background. So it's a lot about terroir. So there's really a lot going on behind this. So it's not just like, doesn't it look modern? Mm. But they're kind of, as I say, they're reimagining what single malt can be. And the other thing I really like, and I'm not sure if anyone else has done this, maybe they have, maybe they haven't, but what you can do, if you look at the bottle, there's like a little unique number printed. You have to look quite hard, sort of on the back at the bottom. It's a 5-digit number. And you can go to their website. You put this in.
Oh, and it tells you all about it.
It gives you all the provenance.
They do that a lot with tequilas. Okay. I don't know about whiskies. They probably do, but I know that there's a lot of them.
But I really like the fact, you know, I did it earlier. You know, so you put it in and it comes up and it says, okay, this was bottled in 2023. It's a vatting of 85 cask, 5 vintages, 6 barley types, 10 cask types. And then you can drill down still further. You can find out what kind of cask we use. So you really can find out about what's in your hand.
You can geek out if you want to.
It's lovely. Yeah. Anyway, having said all of that, let's open it up and see what it tastes like. So get this. There it goes. Let me pass that over to you.
I've missed our little tasting.
Me too. Yeah. Anyway, they're back. They're back. Oh, wow. Yeah.
So, yes, okay.
That's, you're looking at it. I'm nosing it. What are you looking at?
No,
what are you
looking.
What are you getting though? It's, you know.
No, I haven't done the aroma yet. I was just looking to see about the legs so I could see whether it was, you know, going to be strong or whatever, how it worked. So,
but it looks like you say the legs are pretty impressive, aren't they, in the glass? So. But what I'm really liking on the nose,
that's nice.
It smells really malty.
I like that. It's quite the sweetness to it as well, isn't there? Very nice.
Wow. Now, this, I should say, this is 50% ABV. So I think with a lot of these things, you could, if you wanted,
soften them out.
A tiny little drop of water.
But that's quite fruity, actually, to me. I quite like that. And actually, for 50%, it's not too bad. It's not like one of those that makes you rush for the water to balance it out. I just think that actually it's quite easy
it's
drinking.
It's very sippable, isn't it? Yeah. I think there's a lot, you know, going on here. And I really like the fact that although it is punchy, to use one of your favourite words, it's actually incredibly smooth. It slips down really easily. It's got a beautiful finish. And that maltiness, which I really like, is hanging around in a most agreeable way.
Nice.
Yeah.
And that connects the one that we had before with the malt, you know, that sort of thing. I love that. So we're doing a big ups for Scotland this episode without even knowing it.
I know. It's a coincidence, but it's a beautiful coincidence. I mean,
it's lovely.
Also, I should just say, you know, they don't talk about cocktails or anything with this, but I think as with all things, it's what you want to enjoy. I would really like to make something like a Rob Roy with this because I think it would sit really nicely with just a little bit of sweet vermouth. I think that would work really, really well.
Lovely.
So that is your Brocladi. It's, as I say, 50% ABV. And for a 70cl bottle, it's £46, which I think is really, really good.
Really good.
And this is a good way into what they're doing there. This is their flagship. So it's a great way into what they're doing. And now for a cocktail hack from one of our experts.
My name is Steve Scheider from Sip and Guzzle in New York City, amongst other places. And my cocktail hack is the free pour. Now, I'm going to talk in ounces, but this can translate to milliliters as well. But we're always taught that your count is really important. 1 and 2 and 3 and 4, that is 1 ounce. So every count is a quarter ounce. So if you need to do 45 mils, you know, it's 1 and 2 and 3 and 4 and 5 and 6. So keep that in mind. If you have a consistent count, a consistent cadence, then you're going to have a consistent cocktail. So like in the military, there's a cadence for when you're marching. And you just got to kind of practice and get it down. 1 and 2 and 3 and 4. And 1 and 2 and 3 and 4. And you'll be a professional in no time.
Well, here we have, you know, we're coming back with our new episode, so I thought it's only fitting we come back with an amazing book.
Yeah, and a new book.
A brand new book. So this is The Connaught Bar, Recipes and Iconic Creations by Agostino Perone with Giorgio Bajani and Maura Milia. Both of them have also contributed. And I love this book. I could just sit and stroke it all day. But
which
I'll,
is what you're doing.
I'll
right
pass
now.
It along to you first. Yeah. But it's so gorgeous, so tactile, and so, again, elegant. So we've got a lot of elegance in this episode, haven't we?
Haven't we, though? Yeah, I'm happy
Another
about
it. Coincidence.
I love, and I love a bit of elegance in my life.
So tell me.
I love the, as you say, this book, because also they've not opted to go for a cocktail or anything like that on the cover.
No.
It's got a slightly deco feel.
Yes.
And it's, you know, it goes without saying, but I'm going to say it anyway. It's everything you would expect the Connaught Bar
exactly.
to be.
But
it's
then that's hard to capture. You know, you've got this amazing reputation. This is a bar that's been going for 15 years. It's won every award going. Yeah. Everyone that is part of it is so invested, so amazing. And, you know, as well as being five-star, they're really approachable. How do you put all of that into a book, you know? And for me, I think they've captured it, the essence of what the Connaught Bar is all about beautifully.
I agree. It's a coffee table book in the best sense of the word.
Yes.
I mean, the photography is beautiful. It does every single, it's very kind of clean, you know, each spread is on the left. You've got the recipe, from their history. On the right, you've got a beautiful photo that I think all the photography looks like it's in the bar. So it kind of is in situ.
Yes.
But it's just, you know, it just makes every single drink look like just oh my hot. God, I just want to have that right now.
Absolutely. So the thing about it, it takes you behind the bar at the Connaught about the creation of all of their drinks. It gives you an insight into the meticulousness that you, as you said, you imagined would be in this book.
Yeah.
And one of their mantras is a pleasure to please. Oh, and I think that really comes through here. Yeah. You know, Agostino has this wonderful phrase, which is straight up with style. And
don't forget the smile.
Absolutely. And it's all here. So we've got a book that's influenced by their global travels. And also you will see that they've got everything that you expect. You know, it gives you all the details about the equipment. It tells you about how they go about making their drinks. And obviously, the very first recipe is dedicated to the Connaught Martini, which has got to be one of our all-time favourite drinks.
Really,
I wonder, we should do a tally of, I mean, we can't do it now, but we should start how many Connaught Martinis we've had in our life. But it goes through the choice of vodkas and gin, how they make their vermouth, the iterations of the bitters, why the trolley plays such an important part, and that incredible throw that they do,
that high pour, is like when they hold the glass, the mixing glass well above their head, and it always kind of makes me think, I wish I could do that, but I would never try.
It's such an iconic moment in our martini history, and it is part of it. It's not just for show. It does aerate your cocktail.
Yes, it does.
But it looks so beautiful. Theatrical. Another thing I'd love to count, how many times that has been videoed, you know? That's another
thing. By us a lot, let alone everybody else.
Exactly. And then after the martini, it goes into 100 of the cocktails that have been created by the team here. Yeah. We have a wonderful insights from Anastasia Miller, who is an amazing historian, who has tasted every one of the cocktails in this book.
Good Lord. I know we've had one or two, but
that's a great job to have.
Puts us to shame.
Absolutely. So this is one amazing book that we absolutely urge everyone to have in their collection. I would say it's not necessarily something that a beginner cocktail maker would think that they could do, but if you bear with it, I think that you can make these cocktails. There's lovely introductions to all of them from Agostino and the team. And, you know, give it a go. It's like, you know, go to the Connaught and have their amazing service, but you can bring that to your home as well. So this is The Connaught Bar, Recipes and Iconic Creations, and it is available on the 4th of April, and it is $29.95, and it is 256 pages of utter brilliance. The brand new issue of the Cocktail Lovers magazine is out now, and it's dedicated to the amazing women working in the drinks industry. From the change makers to the bar and brand owners and the men they've inspired, it's our way of saying that we celebrate women all year round, not just in March. To get your print or digital issue, or to start a subscription, simply visit thecocktaillovers.com/magazine.
So recently we headed to Birmingham, which was a really nice thing to do because it's Birmingham. People are talking a lot more about the bar scene there, and rightly so.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's a really good thing. It's that community feel that's coming through. Something that we first experienced in Athens, when the people in Athens, they championed each other's bars as much as just their own. So it was all about, let's get people to Athens and then you can experience the whole community, really.
Yeah, and that's, as you say, that's exactly what's going on in Birmingham
right
now. Yes,
exactly. They're doing really, really well on all fronts. But we went along to Passing Fancies because we are huge fans of that bar. That's down in part to Matt Arnold, who we did interview on one of the episodes.
We did,
We'll do a little link to that in the show notes. But he's amazing because not only was he voted the world-class GB winner and came second in the overall world-class global finals.
That was last year, wasn't it?
Second out of 55 competitors. Yeah. So, you know, this is real big ups Birmingham. Mm. And it's made the world take notice of this city, you know, and well-deserved too. So just 2 hours away from London on the train and bam,
and we
you're
were there.
Yeah. Absolutely.
And it's a really nice space. It's kind of got a bit, what's it used? It was
It was part of the Bird's Custard Factory.
Yes, that's it.
So, you know, you've got that hip sort of industrial feel and vibe that's going on. And it's in Digbeth, which has gone through very much, you know, different iterations. Now it's the trendy part of Birmingham. And Passing Fancies, it's great. It's great for the community, but also they're involving not just the bar community. They're working really well with the local market for all of their ingredients that they get. So they change up the menu quite a lot.
Yeah,
so
they're very much in that way, you know, like a really good restaurant where they kind of, they go down to the market and see
what's
there and get, you know, what's in season, what's new, what's different. And they kind of really get off on that challenge of like, oh, what can we do with
it?
And they have a section on their menu called Market Picks, which I think changes probably, I don't know if it's weekly or daily.
Well, it depends on the market finds as well. They have their signatures, but, you know, they're really clever. But not just that. I love the fact that they're so personal, you know, it's a lovely feel. So one of their briefs for themselves and for setting the bar up was to have this kind of kitchen party vibe, which they do. And particularly if you're sitting at the bar, which is like this really lovely open bar where you can engage with the bartenders and really just chill out, really, because most of their drinks are pretty much made. You know, it's like all of the best bars now, I think they do so much work behind the scenes doing all of the prep. And it allows them to, you know, just do a nice little shake and put the last bits together. But it gives them more time to engage with the guests. And I think that makes for a really personable experience, which I love.
Yeah, you know, I agree. I think that's the thing is, you know, going back slightly to the look of the place, it's kind of got a bit of an industrial feel.
Yes.
Like you say, it was in the factory. Also,
and their part was the car park.
Part was the car park. So you can see like the original concrete pillars and markings on the floor. But that is offset, as you say, by that kind
their
of really,
warmth
their
as well.
Friendliness.
Yeah.
And I like that central table. It's a, you know, central bar. It's a bit like a kind of chef's table in a way. So, you know, you're half in, half out. If you want to, there are tables, but, you know, we really like that sort of
and
thing.
It was really communal, wasn't it? But not only are you talking to the bartenders, but you're talking to the who's next to you, you know, and that really, really works. I have to say, sorry, we've got to give them their praise as well, because within the first year of opening, they won the best bar in East Anglia and the Midlands, best new bar, at the Class Bar Awards. Both of those were in the Class Bar Awards. Shortlisted for the best new international cocktail bar in Europe at Tales of the Cocktail. Yeah. And this was all at the time where Matt was made world-class GB Bartender of the Year. So that ain't bad.
No, a lot of accolades there. And having tasted the drinks, you can see why.
Yeah, exactly. You can see why. I had to go for the adult Ribena because it's like, come on, what's not to love?
That is, I should just point that, that is the actual, your actual
it's
name
called
of the drink.
The adult Ribena. Yeah. I think they called it something else when they started, yeah. didn't they?
And then they stumbled across this and thought, hello, that's a much better name.
And then also, isn't it funny what a name can do, because once you change it, all of a sudden people want to go for that. So that was blueberry, cognac and kumquat, and it was absolutely, so I understand why the adult Ribena, but it is absolutely banging drink. Very, very clever, very quaffable, and went down very well with this cocktail lover in the corner. What about you?
Yeah, also, I think what I really like about the whole vibe of the place, and it comes through the menu, is it's kind of a really good balance between serious and playful.
What
goes on behind the scenes, as you say, to make the drinks incredibly serious. But then you get names like Adult Ribena or one of the two drinks I tried, Granny's Apple, you know, which was made with fatty apple, gin and white wine, which was light, zingy, fresh, a good kind of start to the evening kind of drink. Mm. And at the other end of the scale, I also had the short and stout, which was stout caramel, scotch and walnut. And oh, that was deliciousness
that.
In a glass. And it was kind of rich, intense, really flavoursome. But I just like the fact everything has got a little smile about
it. Yes, exactly. Yeah. As in my second drink, which was the dinosaur food, which is what's not to love about that. Rhubarb rum and Palo Santo, really lovely. But then they have other things on the market pick section that we said. So they have a lychee martini, which is a really clever thing to do because there are people laugh about people that love a lychee martini, but actually if you've done something really well like they do here with lychee vodka and bubbles, it's amazing, isn't it?
Crowd pleaser.
Absolutely. And then another one on that was a banana rama with banana scotch and caramel. Hello, come on.
And you can kind of taste some of those things in your head. I think I'm gonna like this.
Yeah.
Also, we should point out the drinks are all around about
11-12 pounds.
Really good. I think really good value.
And they have a good food selection as well. And they do weekend brunches, bottomless brunch, which I think is well worth going to. And we didn't mention they are voted at number 3 in the top 50 cocktail bars as well this year. So get along. We really, really, really recommend it. So whether you're heading into Birmingham or you just want a little jaunt outside of London, because it's not just us as the capital that does really well. There's lots going on in Birmingham. And we will have some reviews of some other ones that we went to as well.
In the new magazine.
Yes, exactly. So you can see pictures of that on our Instagram feed and on our website.
Paul Feig is a film director, producer, screenwriter, actor, and comedian. It's a CV that includes acting in Sabrina the Teenage Witch and directing episodes of the US version of The Office and Mad Men. He's best known, though, as a film director, with credits which include The Ghostbusters reboot, Last Christmas, The Heat, Spy, and the Oscar-nominated Bridesmaids. If this wasn't enough to keep him busy, his love of cocktails and cocktail culture have also led him to adding another two rather significant lines to that CV. As a spirits producer, with his Artingsaw's Gin, and as a drinks author with his book Cocktail Time, The Ultimate Guide to Grown-Up Fun. Clearly, he's an exceptionally busy gentleman, so we are beyond delighted that he's taken time out to join us on this very special episode of the Cocktail Lovers Podcast. Paul,
Welcome to the Cocktail Lovers Podcast.
Hey, where else would I be other than here? My goodness, it's so nice to see you both.
And you, thank you so much. But before we ask you questions, we would love you to make us a martini.
Oh, what? I can't possibly do that. Why, nothing would make me happier. Well, let's do it. Let's get right
Please.
Into this.
I think so.
You know, I know that you're martini lovers, and
we are.
I think it's the royalty of the cocktail world. I don't think there's a better cocktail that's ever been invented.
Absolutely.
And it's weirdly easy to make and really hard to make.
Mm.
If you like martinis and are sort of particular about them, you probably had many an experience in a bar where they don't make it correctly.
Well, we won't go into that just now.
Exactly. But it's interesting. I mean, you know, the main things that a martini needs to be is cold and dry, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah.
But I mean, everybody has a different take on it. Some people love a dirty martini. Some people like a very, you know, wet martini. I will make you what I consider to be the best, which is a very dry martini. We're not going to do it Duke style, which, as we know, that's frozen. Everything's frozen. No ice is touched. I love the Duke's martini, and Alessandro Palazzi is one of my best friends. But at the same time, sometimes those are a little bit, if I may say it, an ass kicker. And so I'm going to use ice and do my favorite, which is a stirred martini.
Marvelous. Right.
Yeah. So we're gonna do it in a mixing glass, not in a shaker. So right now I'm going to grab some ice out of the freezer here.
We have been looking forward to this, Paul, for so long.
Yes. Oh. And it is our thirsty Thursday. So thank you for providing the drink.
The day is the day. So we've got glasses in the freezer. I'm going to leave them in there until the very last minute so that everything is ice cold.
So you've really filled the mixing glass up to the top.
Yeah.
Because some people think, you know, they always use ice quite sparingly. So tell us about ice.
First of all, I'm an American, and so clearly we love our ice. Yeah. I find that sometimes I'll half fill a shaker or a mixing glass, and when the room temperature liquor goes in, gin, it just tends to it eats up the ice for some reason. And that's why I kind of like doing a stirred martini. I want that dilution. So
absolutely.
I don't get crazy. But first thing first is the vermouth.
Mm.
So there's three of us are going to have these, but I really use basically like a drop per martini. So I'm just going to do the smallest little drop.
See, this is a seasoned martini.
That really is.
He knows what he wants.
That is very smooth there. Yeah. I mean, you can be, I'll be extra fancy that I don't normally do and kind of mix the, get the vermouth into the ice like that. I don't know. I'm not normally that fancy.
No, but also, do you like a specific vermouth as well?
Yeah, I prefer Dolan dry.
We love it.
We do too.
Yeah, there's just enough of a, I don't always say sweetness because I don't want a sweet martini, but there's just something about it that's really nice. The other one I really like is Sacred makes a really nice vermouth too. That's what they use at Duke's. Okay. But Dolan is and it's easier to find, to be quite honest.
Mm.
And now, really, I make a 3-ounce martini. So I do it off of a 3 count. I never use a jigger or anything. So it just basically you go 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, and a 1.
Wow.
Just for a little extra.
This is going to be good.
I like your style.
Can you just hold up the bottle for us to see? Because this is your gin. Mm.
Yes.
So, you know, this is what everyone should be looking for right now.
Yeah. We will chat to you a little bit more about that later if we may.
But this is my baby. I've spent 7 years putting this together and everything's called Ardingstall's Brilliant London Dry Gin. Ardingstall was my mom's maiden name.
Oh,
she was from, her family is from Bolton. And I wanted it to sound like something had been around for 150 years. And then that's why the bottle is a decanter shape that we designed. So it's very, I'm very proud of it. And it's a very nice dry gin. It's not too junipery. It's just got just enough. I like to call it kind of an entry-level gin for people who think they don't like gin. Because a lot of Americans don't like gin or think they don't like gin because they're used to something happened early in their lives, and this happened to a lot of people. You'd go down to your friend's parents' basement bar, they'd have a liquor cabinet, and you'd immediately grab the gin. But they would grab like the beefier, the old, and it's if you're not used to that taste, that's like pine cleanser. I mean, it really just hits you hard. And so if you're a kid, you hit that taste, and what happens is people just go like, oh, I don't like gin.
Mm.
And so I'm always having to bring them back from it's not that. So every time they taste mine, it's like, oh, well, I like that. It's like, okay, yes. So there's other kinds of gin. So now I stir it a lot because I really wanted to get very, very cold.
Mm.
As I stirred around the edges, but also I think it's important to then go through the middle of the ice with your spoon here just to keep it nice and cold. Now we're gonna leave it in that as I take our lemons and give us a good big twist. Now the best kind of twist, if you can get like a Malfi lemon,
yes.
So it's really that's the way to go because you want like a good 2 to 3 inch long twist. But we're gonna do a little more subdued ones here. There we go. But as long as we can, there we go. That's pretty good size.
Fabulous.
Not bad.
Nice.
There we go.
And do you make martinis at home as well?
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. Yeah. I love making martinis at home. I love having them out and about. But at home I can, put everything in the freezer, have everything set.
Yeah, yeah.
But still, I always say like cocktail time when you're doing it at home. Doesn't mean just like have your sweatpants on and pour it in a crummy glass, like make it a special thing, even if you're at home. So that's how I like to roll.
We couldn't agree more.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Oh, and now out of the freezer come the glasses.
Wonderful. Mm-hmm. We've got some nice Riedel glassware and mixing glass.
Oh, look at we got one that kind of looks like a cordial.
Yeah.
I like it. All right, now here we go. We're going to pour in.
Yeah, that's the thing with the glassware being in the freezer so long. It's got that nice frosting already.
Well, that's a thing. Mm. If it's not ice cold, it's not worth drinking, I like to say. So, that's the biggest mistake I find most bartenders will do is they just don't make it cold enough. Yeah. And a lot of times it's because they're making so many drinks.
Sure.
They can't invest the time in like letting it sit. But I'm always... Sometimes they just let us, if you haven't do another drink, mix it, leave it in the glass, do something else, and then bring it back. Even if it means a little more dilution, I'd rather just have
the. Well, it really adds to the experience. That whole frosted glass and everything, you're going to get a good martini.
Yeah, exactly. Mm.
I have to say as well, as you free poured that and you guesstimated three drinks.
I did okay.
I think this is a man that makes a lot of
I was going to say, I'm giving myself away right now.
Yeah.
And now we just do a little twist on top, which is, as you know, it's with squeezing it with the skin side out. So a lot of people think who don't make drinks a lot that you do it, you want the inside, the juicy part. But no, it's all about the oil coming out of the thing. There we go. And now you rub it around the edge. There is a technique that some people do where they rub it down the stem so you get the lemon on you. I'm not a fan of that, so I'm not going to do that to you. So you won't have lemony fingers.
Slippy hands.
Exactly. You won't be cursing my name later when you can't get that smell out.
Never.
There we go. And now there's the last one. And here we go. I'll give you the proper martini glass.
Thanks
Thank you, sir.
You bet. Here's my skinny one. There. Oh, there you go. That was an aggressive thank you. Cheers. My fault. I went in hot there.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah.
That's right. Delicious.
You've got the job.
I'm in. Finally. Finally. Respectable work.
Thank you.
Get me out of showbiz. Exactly.
So delicious. So... taking a deep breath after that fabulous martini, or during that fabulous martini. Could we take you back first, Paul, if that's okay, too? Because in the introduction, we mentioned your incredible CV. What came first and how did you get into that whole crazy world?
I started as wanting to be an actor.
Actor, comedian,
all
of those things.
As a kid, and actually became a stand-up comedian when I was, started when I was 15 years old in Detroit, Michigan, and had to get my parents to take me to comedy clubs so that I could get in because they were for adults. They weren't normally let a kid in, but because it was a comedy club.
So you're talking about being a kid. What sort of age are we talking about?
Well, I was 15 when I started doing stand-up. Yeah, exactly. But I was acting since I was like 5 years old and all the school plays and that kind of thing. But I just always knew I wanted to be in show business.
Right.
I've always loved it. And just kind of went forward from there, became a tour guide at Universal Studios. And then from there, I learned about USC Film School, went to film school to learn how, as an actor, to learn how to kind of be an actor in movies, but then fell in love with movie making. And then I was an actor for a long time on, Sabrina the Teenage Witch and all these other shows, and then eventually transitioned behind the camera.
You make it sound easy. Clearly,
it was a 20-year journey, at least. Yeah.
When did the directorial side come out?
I mean, it was always there. When I was a kid, my next door neighbor, Mike Sampson, and I, we would make these short films on, using my dad's, Super 8 camera back at the time, like a home movie camera. And then when I went to film school, I really kind of learned it there. I kind of had a goal to be like a guy who starred in and made and wrote his own movies. It was like Albert Brooks and Woody Allen and those guys. And so I just was always kind of going forward that way. But was always writing. But it was kind of after, I'd been a regular on 5 TV shows as an actor. And then when finally, like the last one was Sabrina the Teenage Witch, all the other ones got canceled. But this one became a hit. And it's like, oh, finally, I've taken care of. I'm going to have a 7-year run on a show. And after the first season, they wrote me out of the show.
Oh, no.
How dare they, right? Exactly. But it was good. It kicked me out of the nest because I think I would have just hung around and been a jobbing actor and...
That's interesting as well, because having been an actor, did that make it easier or harder to get taken seriously when you said, I'm starting to direct now?
It's an interesting question. It was hard when I first said I wanted to do it, because I would say to the directors I was working with, can I follow you? And, the shows I was on, like, would you ever think about hiring me as a director? And like, okay, sure, whatever. They didn't take it seriously, but they saw that I was really interested in it. And I was always just observing. But it really, it took a lot. It was when I got my show Freaks and Geeks that I created, I wanted to direct the pilot, and I just directed a low budget feature film that I made out of pocket. But they didn't kind of take that seriously. So they wouldn't let me direct the pilot. And it wasn't until the very last episode when we pretty much knew we were going to get canceled. They're like, sure, go ahead, direct it if you want. So that was the first time I got to do it professionally. Yeah. It went really well.
So from there, I know big break is probably not the right expression, but what was what your breakthrough moment, do you think, as a director? What was it?
Well, I mean, I think it was creating Freaks and Geeks and having that show become, it was not a kind of financial success, but it was a critical success. Like, everybody loved it, but nobody watched it. One of those things. But that just kind of made me legitimate as a filmmaker, even though I wasn't directing until that last episode. But it just made me more legit in the town. And then when I directed the last episode, it went really well. But it was really, our line producer from that show, when he went on to a show called Arrested Development. Yeah, so much fun. And basically he said, they like you over there. Would you want to direct an episode? I was like, oh, that show's really funny. And so that kind of helped get me going as a TV director.
And you've had such an amazing career. What are some of your highlights to date? Because it's not over. So
I know, really, it's not Lifetime Achievement Award yet. Exactly. That's always, they're putting you out of pasture when they give you that. No, I'm very proud of Freaks and Geeks again. I mean, that was kind of so based on my life and everything. But Bridesmaids obviously has become the movie that everybody talks about. I'm personally more proud of the movie called Spy that I made. That's kind of my favorite one that I've done. Also a movie called Simple Favor. I'm very proud of that because I like to walk kind of a tonal tightrope and take something that shouldn't normally be a comedy and make it a comedy, but make it feel real at the same time. So it's not silly. And so that's really kind of what I try to focus on. And then trying to find and create 3-dimensional roles for women is my
that's
biggest.
That's what we love. It's so nice to actually hero women. And I know that people have been talking about Me Too, but you've been doing this a long time before that you've been championing women. So
yeah,
amen to that.
Oh, thanks. And I love funny women. And I knew so many my whole life.
We need to be funny most.
Thank you. Exactly. But I would watch, I would see all my favorite comedies were all kind of male driven. And then the women were just sort of, pawns just sort of nemesis or, the mean wife or the bitchy girlfriend, all that stuff. And I was like, well, I started seeing people I knew, women I knew from the comedy scene in those movies not being funny. And I was like, why are they not being funny? And you realize, oh, because they're just giving the crappy roles. So that was really when I went, okay, I want to change that.
Do you come from a family of women?
Well, I was an only child, but right. I was very close to my mom. And then my next door neighbors were this family of eight kids, and six of them were girls, and they were all my best friends. So I just always felt more comfortable.
Sassiness as well.
Yeah, I just felt more comfortable around the girls. It was all my nerd guy friends or the girls that I would hang around with, because all the other men, there was just too much kind of toxic sort of masculinity floating around. Mm. And I escaped that.
No, it's fantastic. I'm so happy. And I'm glad that you brought that up, because it's Thanks. Really important. Now, also really important for us
yes.
is your love of, I can't say love of drinks because it makes it sound like you're...
but it is a love, well, I will say.
It's a passion,
yeah,
isn't it?
Very much so.
When did that come into the picture?
I mean, when I was a kid, I never wanted to be a kid. I kind of hated. Yeah, I hated. I didn't like being a kid. It was like, I don't know. I would see kids on TV. It's like, I watch the adults being funny. But I had a real breakthrough moment. Breakthrough. That's hilarious. When I was like, I think 5 or 6. When I got taken to Las Vegas by my parents, they were going to see a Muhammad Ali fight.
Wow.
And so as a little kid, assumed I was going to get a gun. And they marched me down through the casino floor to this nursery that was in the casino, the hotel that they were staying at. And it was this big glass door. And they put me, you know, I was in this glass door with all these other kids. And all I was just at the door watching the casino floor and seeing these glamorous people, and they're drinking martinis, and they're, you know, in gowns and tuxedos. And I was just like, I want that. And I put such a permanent impression in my head. I've never gotten past that.
I know this is actually spooking me out, Paul, because it's like listening to myself talking, apart from I didn't go to that. But when I was, some people say, when did you fall in love with cocktails? And I say, well, when I was about 5 or 6.
Yeah.
Because I wanted to be Cary Grant, or I wanted to be William Powell in the Thin Man films.
Oh, my gosh. Oh, William Powell's my hero, by the way.
I just wanted to wear nice clothes, hang out with glamorous women in places called the Blue Parrot.
Yeah. Make funny jokes and drink.
And they want to laugh at me and at them. And of course, part of that was holding a martini.
And also the dressing up. Yeah. So, you know, this is one of the other things we know and love about you. Very dapper. So we love that. And to me, I think that cocktails is very much associated with clothes and with the whole, it's not just about what's in the glass,
yeah.
It's everything around it. So tell us about your appreciation of the clothes and the cocktails, and then we'll get on to your wonderful.
Yeah, well, I mean, it really is a cocktail culture. Cocktails are part of a lifestyle. And, you know, even, you know, in my book, I say, even if you're going to make a drink at home by yourself, you know, don't just drink it in your sweatpants and don't pour it into a crappy glass. Like, you know, make it an event, make it something nice. And, so, you know, I mean, going to a beautiful bar dressed up with, you know, the bottles are bottom lit and, you know, the bar is gorgeous. That, to me, that's what cocktails are all about. You know, I have a rule, I say, like, never drink anything out of plastic. Don't drink booze out of plastic. Yeah, because then you're just drinking to get drunk. So what's the point? Like, it has to have a kind of a purpose, be a reward at the end of the day, and really represent a lifestyle.
Because also, there's another thing that we've always said is that you can pour a glass of wine, you can pour a glass of champagne, and there's nothing wrong with that, but it's the ritual of cocktails, there's thought that goes into it.
Exactly.
You know? So
yeah.
That which brings us on to your amazing gin, because it's not just another gin in another quintessential drinks bottle.
Right.
You've made a real occasion of this. So tell us about the gin, and first of all, tell us about your decision to make one, and then just talk about the gin itself.
Yeah, well, I've always wanted a gin. I when in my quest to be an adult and grown up, way back when, I just like we all did, said martini. That's the thing. That's adult. But I'd had bad experiences with gin as a kid because you know like sneak into your friend's parents' bar and it just smelled like Pine Sol, you know, like an old Beefeater or something like that. And so I had that impression. So I started drinking vodka martinis. But then, you know, I read early, you know, pretty quickly that like a real martini is gin.
Yeah.
So I was like, okay, I got to learn to like gin. So kind of forced myself at first to like gin.
Oh my God. Yeah. I'm going to do this. That wasn't easy.
No, it wasn't easy. But I had a real breakthrough. The first breakthrough I had was at the Savoy way back when they used to actually have a bar kind of in the lobby. Like there was the grill and outside there was a bar. It was before the Bar Americana, or maybe in addition to that. And I said, I'm gonna have a martini and, you know, gin martini. And they served me in a thistle glass, like you would have, you know, whiskey out of, and it was ice cold. And it was like, a revelation of like, oh, that's why it's good. Like if it's cold and like, even, and it was like a pretty traditional gin. I think it was like a Beefeater or something. And it was just like a mind bender to me. And then after that, discovered Duke's, because I was reading it all about it. And that's where, you know, Ian Fleming discovered the martini, they say. And so went there, and that's when I first met Alessandro. And weirdly, it was when he had first started working there. I didn't realize.
Yeah.
This is like the mid early 90s, and he made the tableside, you know, martini with his throwing the vermouth on the floor, and it was freezing cold again. And that was just like, okay, now I've found my thing. So, but I would have all these different gins and go like, oh, I know exactly what I want my gin to taste. If I could have a gin, I want one taste like this. And been all over the world and tried gins everywhere, but never quite found that. So I always thought if I could do it myself, I could. And finally, I was able to link up with Minhas Distilleries, and then we put this out.
So tell us how the process went for you.
Yeah, it's fascinating because I didn't, you know, you kind of go, I want to taste like this and that. What you do is you go there, and I flew out to their distillery, which is in Wisconsin, and sat with their master distillers. And basically, like, for 2 or 3 hours, it was just like, here's the gins I like. Here's what I want. Here's what I don't want. Here's the things that I don't like about gin. Here's the thing I do like about gin. And they kind of took notes. And they went away and distilled like 8 variations on what I was talking about. So like a number of weeks later, came back, tried all these, and it was pretty apparent, like, no, that's maybe there's something in that. If these two were together, you know, so you really kind of this mix and match, they take that, go away, do another 8 variations based on that. And so, and they do that like 4 or 5 times. So each time you're getting to micro variations. And that's when you're like, ooh, you know, like, oh, this, it, and what the coolest thing I discovered was it's all about, it's about the botanicals clearly, but it's also about alcohol content. And I had no idea that percentage of alcohol could affect taste so much. Yeah. Cause we had the one that I decided, I was like, I think this is the one, but there's something wrong about it. And I was like, maybe it needs more of this or this peel or that kind of thing. And Ravinder Minhas, who owns the company with Manjeet, his sister, he said, you know what? It's 44. It's at 40. What was it? 44%. He said, if we bring it down to 42, I'm thinking you're going to love it. I said, it can't be it. She was, and he did it. And I was just like, it's a miracle. Because at 40%, that same one was too botanical.
Mm.
Yeah.
Oh, the botanicals, can we say? Not all of them, because we don't want people running
exactly,
off.
Exactly, exactly.
Some of the key ones, obviously juniper, but other bits.
Yeah. Well, we've got both orange and lemon peel in there, but we also have black pepper. Because I wanted it to be light and not, because I also wanted to sell this to the American market where people think they don't like gin. And so I weirdly wanted to create a gin that gin lovers would like, but also that people who think they like vodka would like vodka and don't think they like gin could go, oh, I like that. So honestly, my gin really works well as a vodka substitute in about 95% of vodka drinks. It just gives it a little more added interest.
Yeah.
Thank you. So that was kind of the goal on that.
Yeah. And also, I think the other thing, because we've touched on clothes, culture, that whole world around drinks and cocktails.
Yeah.
When we first saw the bottle, we were like, oh my God, this is such a beautiful bottle. Can you tell us a little bit about the thinking behind the bottle?
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, when I was talking to Ravinder about this, I just said, like, I just don't want a standard bottle. That feels like when you're starting something, you're just like, oh yeah, these bottles, you know, you just put them in. But fortunately, his company owns a glass company. So I was like, so we can design this. So I was like, okay. So then we were like, what do we do? And he was the one who said, like, what about like a decanter? I was like, that's it. That's great. Cause I was just like, I want the thing that everybody wants on their bar, you know? And so then I was going around different secondhand stores. It was in one secondhand store and found this old decanter that I bought and I sent to him that had this etching on it and stuff. But I was like, okay, but I want to do this, but then I want to bevel the corners so it's not kind of sharp on the corners, and I want to do this and that. So we kind of took that and ran with it. And then his design team then had to go in and add. Yeah, well, they had to add things to make it easier to ship. You know, for structural reasons.
And also it has this sort of antique feel about it. You know, it's, and it's sustainable because no one's going to throw this bottle away.
That's, I mean, you have no idea how many empty Artisanal bottles are in my house. But what's great is I know I have friends and they basically they'll get like, you know, those LED lights and they'll just put them inside it. Yeah. And we're also, you know, as soon as we kind of get out there more, we're going to start doing refill yeah. bags.
That yeah. makes absolute sense.
Yeah, because we want to, you know, make sure we're not killing the plant.
Mm. And where did the name come from?
It was my mother's maiden name, Ardingstall. Her family is from Bolton. And I just wanted it to sound, well, it's a London Dry. I want to sound like an old London Dry, sound old. And that's why the decanter too. And on the bottle, it says that it's established in 1845. That's the factory where it is distilled. Well, it's for 1845. So technically it's true. Exactly.
You know, you're allowed. That's right. And we've got it positioned by your amazing cocktail book, because this was something you did during lockdown. You were posting daily Instagram, reels or something?
I would just do a live stream. I just decided, like, the day that we kind of all got locked down for the pandemic is like, terrible. And I was going like, what can I do? I'm not a medical professional. I can't get out there and heal people. But I was like, I'll try to help give people something to watch every day. Yeah. So just said, okay, 5 o'clock every day for 100 days. We're not taking a day off. We're just going to do it, you know, then. And we'd do like a 25 minute show, just complete goofiness, me dancing and, you know, but also trying to raise money for all the different organs. So we had a charity aspect to it. We raised a lot of money for various charities, COVID charities. And then once the Black Lives Matter happened we kind of kept going with what was important to us, and just had this appointment kind of thing. And if you started watching, you can still see it on my Instagram account. If you go back to the beginning, I kind of had no idea what I was doing, because I loved cocktails and I had old cocktail books, but I never, other than making like martinis and Negronis, that was kind of it for me. So I just thought, I'm going to teach myself how to do this. So everybody would pick a new recipe out of a book every week and then make it. And you kind of see me fail a lot, but then finally figured out it was fun. I mean, my worst is when I couldn't figure out how to use a citrus squeezer. And since it's got the bowl, I hit the bowl. I thought, you set it in the bowl, you know, it's all over the place.
People love that. He's human too.
Exactly.
And so the book, when did that come? How long did it take?
Well, as I was doing the show, people would write me and say like, because I would never kind of post the recipe. I'd just kind of do it and tell them what it was. And they're like, can you like write them down so we can see them? I was like, maybe I'll put out a book. And I just started writing down the recipes, and then realize, nobody's going to want to buy, you know, I've been through enough trying to sell books where they're like, you know, we need personal stories. Yeah, we want showbiz stories. So I was like, let me just start writing personal stories around the drinks. And then it turned into wanting to give kind of my philosophy on cocktails in general, how to set up your bar, how to throw a cocktail party, the music to play, all the fun stuff. So also my goal was to cocktails are so intimidating to people. Like, people really, they're like, if you make somebody a cocktail, they're like, oh my God, like it's such an easy way to be a great chef without half the work. It's just, you have to have the confidence to do it and to figure out how to do it. And there's so many cocktail books now that I really love, but are so complicated with, you know, molecular kind of all that stuff. And I'm just like, this is for a lazy bartender, you know, just to have fun with it, but still be impressive enough. And so that's why it's a very accessible book.
That was the word I was going to say. It's very accessible, and it breaks it down well for everybody. Oh, but good. Also, your personality is in there too, which is lovely. So it's very chatty. It's very engaging, but it's really informative.
Well, I wanted to show that cocktails at the end of the day are all about fun. That's really what it's all about. It's not about being so erudite that, you know, everybody's put off by it. It's like, no, like back to the William Powell, the Thin Man movies, they are having the time of their lives with these drinks, and just, they're funny, and they're in these cool, you know, those old supper clubs that I wish we could bring those back. That's my goal. here, that's right. Let's just open one. Come on.
Oh, dear. I'm in that supper club now. but also, the other thing about the book, you know, as I say, that there's great recipes in there, but also, can you tell us a little bit about some of the drinks in there that you've created?
I've created about 20 cocktails. It became a fun thing, and like for different charities, people go, can you create a cocktail for this or that? And I was like, I don't know if I can, but just I have this, my bar at home has got so many bottles. That's what happens when I started the show. I probably had like 10 bottles of different things, but each time you find a recipe, it's like, Got to have something. I've got the most obscure. I mean, it's my wife says I look like a bottle hoarder. It's just crazy. So now I call it the test kitchen. But what's so much fun is you just go in and you go like, I want to do something based on this. What are all the things on the shelf that kind of would be in that world? And you just kind of smell them all. And you're like, let's put these together. And you should become like a mad scientist. So I've got ones like one that I really love called the Figtini it's got sake in it. So in with the gin and all the other things. And it's just trying to find things that surprise people a little bit.
Yeah. And also you've made one or two for some friends.
Yes. Well, I made a martini for then Prince Charles, now King Charles. Yeah. Which was a real thrill. One of the most exciting things I've done. I got a friend of mine, Santa Montefiore, who's a great author. Yeah. She and her husband, Seabag Montefiore, who was another amazing book writer. They're good friends with Charles. And she had been showing him my videos from the pandemic, and he thought they were funny. And she was always like, you guys would get along great. I was like, well, please introduce me. And for my 60th birthday, which was last year, she said, you know what? We're going to go out to High Grove and we're going to have tea with him.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah. That's amazing.
So we had tea with him and just my wife and I and Santa and Seabag and Charles. And it was just so much fun. But at the end of the night, I was too nervous to ask. And then Santa's like, well, come on, let's make a martini. And it's like, okay. So they brought out glasses and stuff, and I mixed up my martini. And he's like, this is very good. So and we exchanged a gin. He gave me a bottle of their High Grove gin, and I gave him one of mine. So that I will dine out on that for the rest of my life.
Oh, that's amazing, isn't it?
Rightly so.
Yeah. And any other key moments in your cocktail history? Because now, you know, obviously, director, everything.
Right.
But cocktailian, shall we call you?
Yeah, there you go. Cocktailian. Yes, exactly. I've just tried to teach so many people how to not be afraid of cocktails, you know, and I've driven a few bartenders at places. Great. You know, we were in, I made a movie called Spy when we were in Budapest in Hungary. And so we were like driving around the countryside doing different location scouting. We would stop these bars. First of all, when you travel in Europe, sometimes if you say martini and you get a blank look from the waiter, get out. You're going to get a glass of martini and Rossi vermouth and a shot glass of gin. So, but the places I found to do it, they would still make them really wet and stuff. So in a very nice way, I was like, oh, can I show you guys how to make a martini? So I had a bunch of times where I'd be back behind the bar with these great Hungarian bartenders, like showing them how to do it. So I that was really fun, trying to spread the art of martini-dom around the world.
And now, so you've just finished, we're just going to wrap up because we've taken a lot of your time.
Oh, please.
But we know that you've just finished a film.
Yeah.
Can you tell us anything or when it's going to be out?
Well, we don't know. No, it'll probably be out kind of beginning to middle of next year because of the strikes. They're not sure what the release patterns, but it's really fun. It's an action comedy. It's kind of in the vein of what I did before with Spy and The Heat and all that. It's John Cena and Awkwafina and Simu Liu, who was Shang-Chi in the Shang-Chi movie. And it's just a big action comedy. It's called Jackpot and very fun, very silly. And is a good time.
Can you tell our lovely listeners where they can find Artistoles and also your lovely book?
Well, I mean, the book, I mean, Artistoles, you can get on amazon.co.uk and also jerry.com
as well.
No, because .com doesn't sell, they don't sell alcohol.
Okay.
I know, boo. What do they know? But yay UK. So you can get it there. Also, Jerry's, the great Jerry's in Soho.
Yeah,
I know.
Absolutely.
The gang over there, Alan and the gang. Yeah, they're great. And then through the Whiskey Exchange, you can
brilliant.
Get it too. Yeah.
Brilliant.
And then my book
is available everywhere.
Yeah, you can get it everywhere. It's at Waterstones. If you don't see it in the store, you can get it online. And and I'm very proud of the book. And they go together.
I've just thought of one last thing.
Yes.
Three favorite martini moments.
Oh, well. I mean, it's got to be the first one at the Savoy was because it was such a revelation. And then my first one at Duke's with Alessandro. And then my first one. Yeah. Well, I have to tell you, this is the day I had to finalize my recipe for my gin. I've never been drunker in my life because you got 8 micro variations and my wife is like, you didn't have to drink it. It's like, I just put a few drops on my tongue a million times, you're gone. So it was back and forth. Wait, is this, this? And so that was bad enough. And then once you go, like, I think this is it. It's like, okay, let's try it in a dirty martini. Let's try it in a Negroni. Let's try it in a gin and soda, gin and tonic. And so there's a picture of me like at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, just passed out. But I knew I had picked the right one. It won.
That's amazing. Thank you so much.
Oh, my goodness.
Incredible. Please. Thank you for taking your time. Thank you for making our martinis. And I can't wait to finish mine now.
Yeah.
And
yeah, I'm going to dine out on this forever. The little martini made by Paul Feig.
Oh, my gosh. You're probably too good. Incredible. Trust me.
Thank you. I've met my spirit brother.
There we go. We are spirit animals in the booze world.
Thank you so much, Paul. It's been a pleasure.
You guys are wonderful. Thank you. Cheers.
Thank you. Thank you for listening to this episode of the Cocktail Lovers podcast. We really hope you enjoyed it. If you did, please tell your friends and make sure you never miss an episode by subscribing wherever you get your podcasts. For more details on the people, places and products mentioned today, head over to our website, thecocktaillovers.com.
This episode of the Cocktail Lovers podcast is sponsored by Pessoa Passion Fruit Liqueur, at the heart of the original Porn Star Martini, and bring in a tropical passion fruit twist to all kinds of cocktails. See Pessoa.com for inspiration.